This is Audible.
Brought to you by Puffin.
The Trials of Apollo, Book 5, The Tower of Nero, by Rick Riordan. Read for you by Robbie Damon. To Becky, every journey leads me home to you. 1. Two-headed snake dude, jamming up my quiet ride. Also Meg's shoe stink. When traveling through Washington, D.C., one expects to see a few snakes in human clothing. Still, I was concerned when a two-headed boa constrictor boarded our train at Union Station. The creature had threaded himself through a blue silk business suit, looping his body into the sleeves and trouser legs to approximate human limbs. Two heads protruded from the collar of his dress shirt like twin periscopes. He moved with remarkable grace for what was basically an oversized balloon animal, taking a seat at the opposite end of the coach facing our direction. The other passengers ignored him. No doubt the mist warped their perceptions, making them see just another commuter. The snake made no threatening moves. He didn't even glance at us. For all I knew, he was simply a working stiff monster on his way home. And yet, I could not assume. I whispered to Meg, "I don't want to alarm you." "Shh," she said. Meg took the quiet car rules seriously. Since we'd boarded, most of the noise in the coach had consisted of Meg shushing me every time I spoke, sneezed, or cleared my throat. "But there's a monster," I persisted. She looked up from her complimentary Amtrak magazine, raising an eyebrow above her rhinestone-studded cat-eye glasses. "Where?" I chin-pointed toward the creature. As our train pulled away from the station, his left head stared absently out the window. His right head flicked its forked tongue into a bottle of water, held in the loop that passed for his hand. "It's an amphisbaena," I whispered, then added helpfully, "a snake with a head at each end." Meg frowned, then shrugged, which I took to mean, "looks peaceful enough." Then she went back to reading. I suppressed the urge to argue, mostly because I didn't want to be shushed again. I couldn't blame Meg for wanting a quiet ride. In the past week, we had battled our way through a pack of wild centaurs in Kansas, faced an angry famine spirit at the world's largest fork in Springfield, Missouri. I did not get a selfie. And outrun a pair of blue Kentucky drakens that chased us several times around Churchill Downs. After all that, a two-headed snake in a suit was perhaps not cause for alarm. Certainly he wasn't bothering us at the moment. I tried to relax. Meg buried her face in her magazine, enraptured by an article on urban gardening. My young companion had grown taller in the months that I'd known her, but she was still compact enough to prop her red high tops comfortably on the seat back in front of her. Comfortable for her, I mean, not for me or the other passengers. Meg hadn't changed her shoes since our run around the racetrack, and they looked and smelled like the back end of a horse. At least she had traded her tattered green dress for Dollar General jeans and a green unicornus imparent t-shirt she'd bought at the Camp Jupiter gift shop. With her pageboy haircut beginning to grow out, and an angry red zit erupting on her chin, she no longer looked like a kindergartner. She looked almost her age, a sixth grader entering the circle of hell known as puberty. I had not shared this observation with Meg. For one thing, I had my own acne to worry about. For another thing, as my master, Meg could literally order me to jump out the window and I would be forced to obey. The train rolled through the suburbs of Washington. The late afternoon sun flickered between the buildings like the lamp of an old movie projector. It was a wonderful time of day. When a sun god should be wrapping up his work, heading to the old stables to park his chariot, then kicking back at his palace with a goblet of nectar, a few dozen adoring nymphs, and a new season of The Real Goddesses of Olympus to binge-watch. Not for me, though. I got a creaking seat on an Amtrak train and hours to binge-watch Meg's stinky shoes. At the opposite end of the car, the Amphisbina still made no threatening moves. Unless one considered drinking water from a non-reusable bottle an act of aggression. Why, then, were my neck hairs tingling? I couldn't regulate my breathing. I felt trapped in my window seat. Perhaps I was just nervous about what awaited us in New York. After 6 months in this miserable mortal body, I was approaching my endgame. Meg and I had blundered our way across the United States and back again. We'd freed ancient oracles, defeated legions of monsters, and suffered the untold horrors of the American public transportation system. Finally, after many tragedies, we had triumphed over two of the triumvirate's evil emperors, Commodus and Caligula, at Camp Jupiter. But the worst was yet to come. We were headed back to where our troubles began, Manhattan, the base of Nero Claudius Caesar, Meg's abusive stepfather and my least favorite fiddle player. Even if we somehow managed to defeat him, a still more powerful threat lurked in the background. My arch nemesis, Python, who had taken up residence at my sacred Oracle of Delphi as if it were some cut-rate Airbnb. In the next few days, either I would defeat these enemies and become the god Apollo again, assuming my father Zeus allowed it, or I would die trying. One way or the other, my time as Lester Papadopoulos was coming to an end. Perhaps it wasn't a mystery why I felt so agitated. I tried to focus on the beautiful sunset. I tried not to obsess about my impossible to-do list or the two-headed snake in row 16. I made it all the way to Philadelphia without having a nervous breakdown. But as we pulled out of 30th Street Station, two things became clear to me. One, the Amphisbina wasn't leaving the train, which meant he probably wasn't a daily commuter. And two, my danger radar was pinging more strongly than ever. I felt stalked. I had the same ants in the pores feeling I used to get when playing hide-and-seek with Artemis and her hunters in the woods, just before they jumped from the brush and riddled me with arrows. That was back when my sister and I were younger deities and could still enjoy such simple amusements. I risked a look at the Amphisbina and nearly jumped out of my jeans. The creature was staring at me now, his four yellow eyes unblinking and... were they beginning to glow? Oh, no, no, no. Glowing eyes are never good. I need to get out, I told Meg. Shh. But that creature... I want to check on it. His eyes are glowing. Meg squinted at Mr. Snake.
No, they're not. They're gleaming. Besides, he's just sitting there.
He's sitting there suspiciously. The passenger behind us whispered, shh. Meg raised her eyebrows at me. Told you so. I pointed at the aisle and pouted at Meg. She rolled her eyes, untangled herself from the hammock-like position she'd taken up, and let me out.
Don't start a fight, she ordered.
Great. Now I would have to wait for the monster to attack before I could defend myself. I stood in the aisle, waiting for the blood to return to my numb legs. Whoever invented the human circulatory system had done a lousy job. The Amphisbina hadn't moved. His eyes were still fixed on me. He appeared to be in some sort of trance. Maybe he was building up his energy for a massive attack. Did Amphisbini do that? I scoured my memory for facts about the creature, but came up with very little. The Roman writer Pliny claimed that wearing a live baby amphisbaena around your neck could assure you a safe pregnancy. Not helpful. Wearing its skin could make you attractive to potential partners. No, also not helpful. Its heads could spit poison. Aha! That must be it. The monster was powering up for a dual-mouthed poison vomit hose down of the train car. What to do? Despite my occasional bursts of godly power and skill, I couldn't count on one when I needed it. Most of the time, I was still a pitiful 17-year-old boy. I could retrieve my bow and quiver from the overhead luggage compartment. Being armed would be nice. Then again, that would telegraph my hostile intentions. Meg would probably scold me for overreacting. I'm sorry, Meg, but those eyes were glowing, not gleaming. If only I'd kept a smaller weapon, perhaps a dagger concealed in my shirt. Why wasn't I the god of daggers? I decided to stroll down the aisle as if I were simply on my way to the restroom. If the amphisbaena attacked, I would scream. Hopefully Meg would put down her magazine long enough to come rescue me. At least I would have forced the inevitable confrontation. If the snake didn't make a move, well, perhaps he really was harmless. Then I would go to the restroom because I actually needed to. I stumbled on my tingly legs, which didn't help my look casual approach. I considered whistling a carefree tune, then remembered the whole quiet car thing. Four rows from the monster, my heart hammered. Those eyes were definitely glowing, definitely fixed on me. The monster sat unnaturally motionless, even for a reptile. Two rows away, my trembling jaw and sweaty face made it hard to appear nonchalant. The amphisbaena's suit looked expensive and well-tailored. Probably being a giant snake, he couldn't wear clothes right off the rack. His glistening brown and yellow diamond-patterned skin did not seem like the sort of thing one might wear to look more attractive on a dating app. Unless one dated boa constrictors. When the amphisbaena made his move, I thought I was prepared. I was wrong. The creature lunged with incredible speed, lassoing my wrist with the loop of his false left arm. I was too surprised even to yelp. If he'd meant to kill me, I would have died. Instead, he simply tightened his grip, stopping me in my tracks, clinging to me as if he were drowning. He spoke in a low double hiss that resonated in my bone marrow. The son of Hades, cavern runner's friend, must show the secret way unto the throne. On Nero's own your lives do now depend. As abruptly as he'd grabbed me, he let me go. Muscles undulated along the length of his body as if he were coming to a slow boil. He sat up straight, elongating his necks until he was almost noses to nose with me. The glow faded from his eyes.
What am I do?
His left head looked at his right head.
How?
His right head seemed equally mystified. It looked at me.
Who are? Wait, did I miss the Baltimore stop? My wife is going to kill me.
I was too shocked to speak. Those lines he'd spoken, I recognized the poetic meter. This amphisbaena had delivered a prophetic message. It dawned on me that this monster might in fact be a regular commuter who'd been possessed, hijacked by the whims of fate because, of course, he was a snake. Since ancient times, snakes have channeled the wisdom of the earth because they live underground. A giant serpent would be especially susceptible to oracular voices. I wasn't sure what to do. Should I apologize to him for his inconvenience? Should I give him a tip? And if he wasn't the threat that had set off my danger radar, what was? I was saved from an awkward conversation, and the Amphisbina was saved from his wife killing him. When two crossbow bolts flew across the coach and killed him instead, pinning the poor snake's necks against the back wall, I shrieked. Several nearby passengers shushed me. The Amphisbina disintegrated into yellow dust, leaving nothing behind but a well-tailored suit. I raised my hand slowly and turned, as if pivoting on a landmine. I half expected another crossbow bolt to pierce my chest. There was no way I could dodge an attack from someone with such accuracy. The best I could do was appear non-threatening. I was good at that. At the opposite end of the coach stood two hulking figures. One was a Germanus. Judging from his beard and scraggly, beaded hair, his hide armor, and his imperial gold greaves and breastplate. I did not recognize him, but I'd met too many of his kind recently. I had no doubt who he worked for. Nero's people had found us. Meg was still seated, holding her magical twin golden Sika blades. But the Germanus had the edge of his broadsword against her neck, encouraging her to stay put. His companion was the crossbow shooter. She was even taller and heavier, wearing an Amtrak conductor's uniform that fooled no one, except apparently all the mortals on the train, who didn't give the newcomers a second look. Under her conductor's hat, the shooter's scalp was shaved on the sides, leaving a lustrous brown mane down the middle that curled over her shoulder in a braided rope. Her short-sleeved shirt stretched so tight against her muscular shoulders, I thought her epaulets and name tag would pop off. Her arms were covered with interlocking circular tattoos, and around her neck was a thick golden ring. A torque. I hadn't seen one of those in ages. This woman was a Gaul. The realization made my stomach frost over. In the old days of the Roman Republic, Gauls were feared even more than the Germani. She had already reloaded her double crossbow and was pointing it at my head. Hanging from her belt was a variety of other weapons. A gladius, a club, and a dagger. Oh, sure, she got a dagger. Keeping her eyes on me, she jerked her chin toward her shoulder, the universal sign for, "Come here or I'll shoot you." I calculated my odds of charging down the aisle and tackling our enemies before they killed Meg and me. Zero. My odds of cowering in fear behind a chair while Meg took care of both of them? Slightly better, but still not great. I made my way down the aisle, my knees wobbling. The mortal passengers frowned as I passed. As near as I could figure, they thought my shriek had been a disturbance unworthy of the quiet car, and the conductor was now calling me out. The fact that the conductor wielded a crossbow and had just killed a two-headed serpentine commuter did not seem to register with them. I reached my row and glanced at Meg, partly to make sure she was all right, partly because I was curious why she hadn't attacked. Just holding a sword to Meg's throat was normally not enough to discourage her. She was staring in shock at the Gaul.
Lugusalwa?
The woman nodded curtly, which told me two horrifying things. First, Meg knew her. Second, Lugusalwa was her name. As she regarded Meg, the fierceness in the Gaul's eyes dialed back a few notches from, "I am going to kill everyone now," to, "I am going to kill everyone soon."
"Yes, sapling," said the Gaul. "Now put away your weapons before Gunther is obliged to chop off your head."
2. Pastries for dinner? Your fave Lester could never. Got to pee. Later. The sword wielder looked delighted.
"Chop off head?"
His name, Gunther, was printed on an Amtrak name tag he wore over his armor, his only concession to being in disguise. Not yet. Luguselwa kept her eyes on us. As you can see, Gunther loves decapitating people, so let's play nice. Come along.
Lou,
Meg said.
Why?
When it came to expressing hurt, Meg's voice was a fine-tuned instrument. I'd heard her mourn the deaths of our friends. I'd heard her describe her father's murder. I'd heard her rage against her foster father, Nero, who had killed her dad and twisted her mind with years of emotional abuse. But when addressing Luguselwa, Meg's voice played in an entirely different key. She sounded as if her best friend had just dismembered her favorite doll for no reason and without warning. She sounded hurt, confused, incredulous, as if, in a life full of indignities, this was one indignity she never could have anticipated. Lou's jaw muscles tightened. Veins bulged on her temples. I couldn't tell if she was angry, feeling guilty, or showing us her warm and fuzzy side.
Do you remember what I taught you about duty, Sapling?
Meg gulped back a sob.
Do you?
Lou said, her voice sharper.
Yes,
Meg whispered. Then get your things and come along. Lou pushed Gunther's sword away from Meg's neck. The big man grumbled,
"Humph,"
which I assumed was Germanic for,
"I never get to have any fun."
Looking bewildered, Meg rose and opened the overhead compartment. I couldn't understand why she was going along so passively with Luguselwa's orders. We'd fought against worse odds. Who was this Gull?
"That's it,"
I whispered as Meg passed me my backpack.
"We're giving up."
"Lester," Meg muttered,
"just do what I say."
I shouldered my pack, my bow and quiver. Meg fastened her gardening belt around her waist. Lou and Gunther did not look concerned that I was now armed with arrows and Meg with an ample supply of heirloom vegetable seeds. As we got our gear in order, the mortal passengers gave us annoyed looks. But no one shushed us, probably because they did not want to anger the two large conductors escorting us out.
"This way,"
Lou pointed with her crossbow to the exit behind her. "The others are waiting."
"The others?"
I did not want to meet any more Gauls or Gunthers. But Meg followed Lou meekly through the plexiglass double doors. I went next, Gunther breathing down my neck behind me, probably contemplating how easy it would be to separate my head from my body. A gangway connected our car to the next, a loud, lurching hallway with automatic double doors on either end, a closet-sized restroom in one corner, and exterior doors to port and starboard. I considered throwing myself out one of these exits and hoping for the best. But I feared the best would mean dying on impact with the ground. It was pitch black outside. Judging from the rumble of the corrugated steel panels beneath my feet, I guessed the train was going well over 100 miles an hour. Through the far set of plexiglass doors, I spied the cafe car. A grim concession counter, a row of booths, and a half dozen large men milling around. More Germani. Nothing good was going to happen in there. If Meg and I were going to make a break for it, this was our chance. Before I could make any sort of desperate move, Luguselwa stopped abruptly just before the cafe car doors. She turned to face us.
"Gunther,"
she snapped, "check the bathroom for infiltrators." This seemed to confuse Gunther as much as it did me, either because he didn't see the point, or he had no idea what an infiltrator was. I wondered why Luguselwa was acting so paranoid. Did she worry we had a legion of demigods stashed in the restroom, waiting to spring out and rescue us? Or perhaps, like me, she'd once surprised a cyclops on the porcelain throne and no longer trusted public toilets. After a brief stare down, Gunther muttered, "Hmm," and did as he was told. As soon as he poked his head in the loo, Lou, the other Lou, not Lou, fixed us with an intent stare.
"When we go through the tunnel to New York," she said,
"you will both ask to use the toilet."
I'd taken a lot of silly commands before, mostly from Meg, but this was a new low. "Actually, I need to go now," I said.
"Hold it," she said.
I glanced at Meg to see if this made any sense to her, but she was staring morosely at the floor. Gunther emerged from potty patrol.
"Nobody."
Poor guy. If you had to check a train's toilet for infiltrators, the least you could hope for was a few infiltrators to kill.
"Right, then," said Lou. "Come on."
She herded us into the cafe car. Six Germani turned and stared at us, their meaty fists full of danishes and cups of coffee.
Barbarians.
Who else would eat breakfast pastries at night? The warriors were dressed like Gunther in hides and gold armor, cleverly disguised behind Amtrak name tags. One of the men, Edelbort, the number one most popular Germanic baby boy's name in 162 BCE, barked a question at Lou in a language I didn't recognize. Lou responded in the same tongue. Her answer seemed to satisfy the warriors, who went back to their coffee and danishes. Gunther joined them, grumbling about how hard it was to find good enemies to decapitate.
"Sit there,"
Lou told us, pointing to a window booth. Meg slid in glumly. I settled in across from her, propping my longbow, quiver, and backpack next to me. Lou stood within earshot, just in case we tried to discuss an escape plan. She needn't have worried. Meg still wouldn't meet my eyes. I wondered again who Lugus Elwa was, and what she meant to Meg. Not once in our months of travel had Meg mentioned her. This fact disturbed me. Rather than indicating that Lou was unimportant, it made me suspect she was very important indeed. And why a Gaul? Gauls had been unusual in Nero's Rome. By the time he became emperor, most of them had been conquered and forcibly civilized. Those who still wore tattoos and torques and lived according to the old ways had been pushed to the fringes of Brittany or forced over to the British Isles. The name Lugus Elwa, my Gaulish had never been very good, but I thought it meant beloved of the god Lugus. I shuddered. Those Celtic deities were a strange, fierce bunch. My thoughts were too unhinged to solve the puzzle of Lou. I kept thinking back to the poor Amphisbaena she'd killed, a harmless monster commuter who would never make it home to his wife, all because a prophecy had made him its pawn. His message had left me shaken. A verse in Terzarima, like the one we'd received at Camp Jupiter. "O son of Zeus, the final challenge face, the tower of Nero, too alone ascend. Dislodge the beast that hast usurped thy place." Yes, I had memorized the cursed thing. Now we had our second set of instructions, clearly linked to the previous set, because the first and third lines rhymed with ascend. Stupid Dante and his stupid idea for a never-ending poem structure. The son of Hades, cavern runner's friend, must show the secret way unto the throne. On Nero's own your lives do now depend. I knew a son of Hades, Nico D'Angelo. He was probably still at Camp Half-Blood on Long Island. If he had some secret way to Nero's throne, he'd never get the chance to show us unless we escaped this train. How Nico might be a cavern runner's friend, I had no idea. The last line of the new verse was just cruel. We were presently surrounded by Nero's own, so of course our lives depended on them. I wanted to believe there was more to that line, something positive. Maybe tied to the fact that Lou had ordered us to go to the bathroom when we entered the tunnel to New York. But given Lou's hostile expression, and the presence of her 7 heavily caffeinated and sugar-fueled Germanus friends, I didn't feel optimistic. I squirmed in my seat. Oh, why had I thought about the bathroom? I really needed to go now. Outside, the illuminated billboards of New Jersey zipped by. Ads for auto dealerships where you could buy an impractical race car, injury lawyers you could employ to blame the other drivers once you crashed that race car, casinos where you could gamble away the money you won from the injury lawsuits. The great circle of life. The station stop for Newark Airport came and went. God's help me. I was so desperate I considered making a break for it. In Newark. Meg stayed put. So I did too. The tunnel to New York would be coming up soon. Perhaps, instead of asking to use the restroom, we could spring into action against our captors. Lou seemed to read my thoughts.
It's a good thing you surrendered. Nero has 3 other teams like mine on this train alone. Every passage, every train, bus, and flight into Manhattan has been covered. Nero's got the Oracle of Delphi on his side. Remember, he knew you were coming tonight. You are never going to get into the city without being caught.
Way to crush my hopes, Lugu Selwa. Telling me that Nero had his ally Python peering into the future for him, using my sacred oracle against me. Harsh. Meg, however, suddenly perked up, as if something Lou said gave her hope.
So how is it you're the one who found us, Lou? Just luck?
Lou's tattoos rippled as she flexed her arms, the swirling Celtic circles making me seasick.
I know you, sapling, she said. I know how to track you. There is no luck.
I could think of several gods of luck who would disagree with that statement, but I didn't argue. Being a captive had dampened my desire for small talk. Lou turned to her companions.
As soon as we get to Penn Station, we deliver our captives to the escort team. I want no mistakes. No one kills the girl or the god unless it's absolutely necessary.
Is it necessary now?
Gunther asked.
No, Lou said. The Princeps has plans for them. He wants them alive.
The Princeps.
My mouth tasted bitterer than the bitterest Amtrak coffee. Being marched through Nero's front door was not how I'd planned to confront him. One moment we were rumbling across a wasteland of New Jersey warehouses and dockyards. The next, we plunged into darkness, entering the tunnel that would take us under the Hudson River. On the intercom, a garbled announcement informed us that our next stop would be Penn Station.
I need to pee, Meg announced.
I stared at her, dumbfounded.
Was she really going to follow Lou's strange instructions?
The Gaul had captured us and killed an innocent two-headed snake. Why would Meg trust her? Meg pressed her heel hard on the top of my foot.
Yes,
I squeaked.
I also need to pee.
For me, at least, this was painfully true.
Hold it,
Gunther grumbled.
I really need to pee.
Meg bounced up and down. Lou heaved a sigh. Her exasperation did not sound faked.
Fine. She turned to her squad. I'll take them. The rest of you stay here and prepare to disembark.
None of the Germani objected. They'd probably heard enough of Gunther's complaints about potty patrol. They began shoving last-minute Danishes into their mouths and gathering up their equipment as Meg and I extracted ourselves from our booth.
Your gear, Lou reminded me.
I blinked. Right. Who went to the bathroom without their bow and quiver? That would be stupid.
I grabbed my things.
Lou herded us back into the gangway. As soon as the double doors closed behind her, she murmured,
Now. Meg bolted for the quiet car.
Hey! Lou shoved me out of the way, pausing long enough to mutter,
Lock the door. Decouple the coaches.
Then raced after Meg. Do what now? Two scimitars flashed into existence in Lou's hands.
Wait, she had Meg's swords?
No. Just before the end of the gangway, Meg turned to face her, summoning her own blades. And the two women fought like demons.
They were both Dimakairai? The rarest form of gladiator?
That must mean... I didn't have time to think about what that meant. Behind me, the Germani were shouting and scrambling. They would be through the doors any second.
I didn't understand exactly what was happening,
but it occurred to my stupid, slow, mortal brain that perhaps, just perhaps, Lou was trying to help us. If I didn't block the doors like she'd asked, we would be overrun by seven angry, sticky-fingered barbarians. I slammed my foot against the base of the double doors. There were no handles. I had to press my palms against the panels and push them together to keep them shut. Gunther tackled the doors at full speed, the impact nearly dislocating my jaw. The other Germani piled in behind him. My only advantages were the narrow space they were in, which made it difficult for them to combine their strength and the Germani's own lack of sense. Instead of working together to pry the doors apart, they simply pushed and shoved against one another, using Gunther's face as a battering ram. Behind me, Lou and Meg jabbed and slashed, their blades furiously clanging against one another.
Good sapling, Lou said under her breath. You remember your training.
Then louder, for the sake of our audience.
I'll kill you, foolish girl!
I imagined how this must look to the Germani on the other side of the plexiglass. Their comrade Lou, trapped in combat with an escaped prisoner, while I attempted to hold them back. My hands were going numb. My arm and chest muscles ached. I glanced around desperately for an emergency door lock, but there was only an emergency open button. What good was that? The train roared on through the tunnel. I estimated we had only minutes before we pulled into Penn Station, where Nero's escort team would be waiting. I did not wish to be escorted.
Decouple the coaches, Lou had told me.
How was I supposed to do that? Especially while holding the gangway door shut?
I was no train engineer.
Choo-choos were more Hephaestus's thing. I looked over my shoulder, scanning the gangway. Shockingly, there was no clearly labeled switch that would allow a passenger to decouple the train.
What was wrong with Amtrak?
There. On the floor, a series of hinged metal flaps overlapped, creating a safe surface for passengers to walk across when the train twisted and turned. One of those flaps had been kicked open, perhaps by Lou, exposing the coupling underneath. Even if I could reach it from where I stood, which I couldn't, I doubted I would have the strength and dexterity to stick my arm down there, cut the cables, and pry open the clamp. The gap between the floor panels was too narrow, the coupling too far down. Just to hit it from here, I would have to be the world's greatest archer.
Oh, wait.
Against my chest, The doors were bowing under the weight of 7 barbarians. An axe blade jutted through the rubber lining next to my ear. Turning around so I could shoot my bow would be madness. Yes, I thought hysterically. Let's do that. I bought myself a moment by pulling out an arrow and jabbing it through the gap between the doors. Gunther howled. The pressure eased as the clump of Germani readjusted. I flipped around so my back was to the plexiglass, one heel wedged against the base of the doors. I fumbled with my bow and managed to knock an arrow. My new bow was a god-level weapon from the vaults of Camp Jupiter. My archery skills had improved dramatically over the last 6 months. Still, this was a terrible idea. It was impossible to shoot properly with one's back against a hard surface. I simply couldn't draw the bowstring far enough. Nevertheless, I fired. The arrow disappeared into the gap in the floor, completely missing the coupling. "Penn Station in just a minute," said a voice on the PA system. "Doors will open on the left." "Running out of time," Lou shouted. She slashed at Meg's head. Meg jabbed low, nearly impaling the gull's thigh. I shot another arrow. This time the point sparked against the clasp, but the train cars remained stubbornly connected. The Germani pounded against the doors. A plexiglass panel popped out of its frame. A fist reached through and grabbed my shirt. With a desperate shriek, I lurched away from the doors and shot one last time at a full draw. The arrow sliced through the cables and slammed into the clasp. With a shudder and a groan, the coupling broke. Germani poured into the gangway as I leaped across the widening gap between the coaches. I almost skewered myself on Meg's and Lou's scimitars, but I somehow managed to regain my footing. I turned as the rest of the train shot into the darkness at 70 miles an hour. 7 Germani staring at us in disbelief and yelling insults I will not repeat. For another 50 feet, our decoupled section of the train rolled forward of its own momentum, then slowed to a stop. Meg and Lou lowered their weapons. A brave passenger from the quiet car dared to stick her head out and ask what was going on. I shushed her. Lou glared at me. "Took you long enough, Lester. Now let's move before my men come back. You two just went from capture alive to proof of death is acceptable." 3. Arrow of Wisdom. Hook me up with a hideout. No, not that one. No! "I'm confused," I said as we stumbled along in the dark tunnels. "Are we still prisoners?" Lou glanced at me, then at Meg. "Dense for a god, isn't he?"
"You have no idea," Meg grumbled.
"Do you work for Nero or not?" I demanded. "And how exactly..." I wagged my finger from Lou to Meg, silently asking, "How do you know each other? Or perhaps, are you related since you're equally annoying?" Then I caught the glint of their matching gold rings, one on each of their middle fingers. I remembered the way Lou and Meg had fought, their 4 blades slicing and stabbing in perfect synchronization. The obvious truth smacked me in the face. "You trained Meg," I realized, "to be a Demachiris. And she's kept her skills sharp." Lou elbowed Meg affectionately. "I'm pleased, sapling." I had never seen Meg look so proud about anything. She tackled her old trainer in a hug.
"I knew you weren't bad."
Lou didn't seem to know what to do with the hug. She patted Meg on the shoulder.
"I'm plenty bad, sapling. But I'm not going to let Nero torture you anymore. Let's keep moving."
torture. Yes, that was the word. I wondered how Meg could trust this woman. She'd killed the Amphisbina without batting an eye. I had no doubt she would do the same to me if she felt it necessary. Worse, Nero paid her salary. Whether Lou had saved us from capture or not, she'd trained Meg, which meant she must have stood by for years while Nero tormented my young friend emotionally and mentally. Lou had been part of the problem. Part of Meg's indoctrination into the Emperor's twisted family. I worried that Meg was slipping into her old patterns. Perhaps Nero had figured out a way to manipulate her indirectly through this former teacher she admired. On the other hand, I wasn't sure how to broach that subject. We were trekking through a maze of subway maintenance tunnels with only Lou as our guide. She had a lot more weapons than I did. Also, Meg was my master. She told me we were going to follow Lou, so that's what we did. We continued our march, Meg and Lou trudging side by side, me straggling behind. I'd like to tell you I was guarding their six or performing some other important task, but I think Meg had just forgotten about me. Overhead, steel-caged work lights cast prison bar shadows across the brick walls. Mud and slime coated the floor, exuding a smell like the old casks of wine Dionysus insisted on keeping in his cellar, despite the fact that they had long ago turned to vinegar. At least Meg's sneakers would no longer smell like horse poop. They would now be coated with new and different toxic waste. After stumbling along for another million miles, I ventured to ask, "Miss Lou, where are we going?" I was startled by the volume of my own voice echoing through the dark. "Away from the search grid," she said, as if this were obvious. "Nero has tapped most of the closed-circuit cameras in Manhattan. We need to get off his radar." It was a bit jarring to hear a Gaulish warrior talking about radar and cameras. I wondered again how Lou had come into Nero's service. As much as I hated to admit it, the emperors of the Triumvirate were basically minor gods. They were picky about which followers they allowed to spend eternity with them. The Germani made sense. Dense and cruel as they might be, the Imperial bodyguards were fiercely loyal. But why a Gaul? Lugacelwa must have been valuable to Nero for reasons beyond her sword skills. I didn't trust that such a warrior would turn on her master after two millennia. My suspicions must have radiated from me like heat from an oven. Lou glanced back and noted my frown. "Apollo, if I wanted you dead, you would already be dead." True, I thought. But Lou could have added, "If I wanted to trick you into following me so I could deliver you alive to Nero, this is exactly what I'd be doing." Lou quickened her pace. Meg scowled at me like, "Be nice to my Gaul." Then she hurried to catch up. I lost track of time. The adrenaline spike from the train fight faded, leaving me weary and sore. Sure, I was still running for my life, but I'd spent most of the last 6 months running for my life. I couldn't maintain a productive state of panic indefinitely. Tunnel goo soaked into my socks. My shoes felt like squishy clay pots. For a while, I was impressed by how well Lou knew the tunnels. She forged ahead, taking us down one turn after another. Then, when she hesitated at a junction a bit too long, I realized the truth. "You don't know where we're going," I said. She scowled. "I told you. Away from the search grid. Cameras, yes. But where are we going?" "Somewhere. Anywhere safe." I laughed. I surprised myself by actually feeling relieved. If Lou was this clueless about our destination, then I felt safer trusting her. She had no grand plan. We were lost. What a relief.
Lou did not seem to appreciate my sense of humor.
Excuse me if I had to improvise, she grumbled. You're fortunate I found you on that train, rather than one of the Emperor's other search parties. Otherwise, you'd be in Nero's holding cell right now.
Meg gave me another scowl.
Yeah, Lester. Besides, it's fine.
She pointed to an old section of Greek key design tile along the left-hand corridor, perhaps left over from an abandoned subway line.
I recognize that. There should be an exit up ahead.
I wanted to ask how she could possibly know this. Then I remembered Meg had spent a great deal of her childhood roaming dark alleys, derelict buildings, and other strange and unusual places in Manhattan, with Nero's blessing. The evil imperial version of free-range parenting. I could imagine a younger Meg exploring these tunnels, doing cartwheels in the muck, and growing mushrooms in forgotten locations. We followed her for, I don't know, 6 or 7 miles. That's what it felt like, at least. Once we stopped abruptly when a deep and distant boom echoed through the corridor. Train? I asked nervously, though we'd left the tracks behind long ago. Lou tilted her head.
No, that was thunder.
I didn't see how that could be. When we'd entered the tunnel in New Jersey, there'd been no sign of rain. I didn't like the idea of sudden thunderstorms so close to the Empire State Building, entrance to Mount Olympus, home of Zeus, aka Big Daddy Lightning Bolt. Undeterred, Meg forged ahead. Finally, our tunnel dead-ended at a metal ladder. Overhead was a loose manhole cover, light and water spilling from one edge like a weeping crescent moon.
I remember this opens to an alleyway, Meg announced. No cameras. At least there weren't any last time I was here.
Lou grunted, as if to say, good work, or maybe just, this is going to suck. The Gaul ascended first. Moments later, the three of us stood in a storm-lashed alley between two apartment buildings. Lightning forked overhead, lacing the dark clouds with gold. Rain needled my face and poked me in the eyes. Where had this tempest come from? Was it a welcome home present from my father, or a warning? Or maybe it was just a regular summer storm. Sadly, my time as Lester had taught me that not every meteorological event was about me. Thunder rattled the windows on either side of us. Judging from the yellow brick facades of the buildings, I guessed we were on the Upper East Side somewhere, though that seemed an impossibly long underground walk from Penn Station. At the end of the alley, taxis zipped down a busy street. Park Avenue? Lexington? I hugged my arms. My teeth chattered. My quiver was starting to fill with water, the strap getting heavier across my shoulder. I turned to Lou and Meg. I don't suppose either of you has a magic item that stops rain. From the belt of her infinite weapons, Lou pulled something that I'd assumed was a police baton. She clicked a button on the side, and it blossomed into an umbrella. Naturally, it was just big enough for Lou and Meg. I sighed. I walked right into that, didn't I?
Yep,
Meg agreed. I pulled my backpack over my head, which effectively stopped 0.003% of the rain from hitting my face. My clothes were plastered to my skin. My heart slowed and sped up at random, as if it couldn't decide whether to be exhausted or terrified. What now? I asked.
We find some place to regroup, said Lou.
I eyed the nearest dumpster. With all the real estate Nero controls in Manhattan, you don't have one secret base we could use. Lou's laugh was the only dry thing in that alley.
I told you. Nero monitors all public security cameras in New York. How closely do you think he monitors his own properties? You want to risk it?
I hated that she had a point.
I wanted to trust Luguselwa, because Meg trusted her. I recognized that Lu had saved us on the train. Also, the Amphisbina's last line of prophecy tumbled around in my head. On Nero's own, your lives do now depend. That could refer to Lu, which meant she might be trustworthy. On the other hand, Lu had killed the Amphisbina. For all I knew, if he had lived a few more minutes, he might have spouted another bit of iambic pentameter. Not Lu, not Lu. Don't ever trust the Gaul. So if you're on our side, I said, why all the pretending on the train? Why kill that Amphisbina? Why the charade about escorting us to the bathroom? Lu grunted. First of all, I'm on Meg's side. Don't much care about you. Meg smirked.
That's a good point.
As for the monster, Lu shrugged. It was a monster. It'll regenerate in Tartarus eventually. No great loss.
I suspected Mr. Snake's wife might disagree with that. Then again, not too long ago, I had regarded demigods in much the same way that Lu regarded the Amphisbina.
As for the play-acting, she said, if I'd turned on my comrades, I ran the risk of you two getting killed, me getting killed, or one of my men escaping and reporting back to Nero. I would have been outed as a traitor.
But they all got away, I protested. They'll all report back to Nero and...
Oh. They'll tell Nero...
That the last time they saw me, Lu said, I was fighting like crazy, trying to stop you from escaping.
Meg detached herself from Lu's side, her eyes widening.
But Nero will think you're dead? You can stay with us.
Lu gave her a rueful smile.
No, sapling. I'll have to go back soon. If we're lucky, Nero will believe I'm still on his side.
But why?
Meg demanded.
You can't go back.
It's the only way, Lu said. I had to make sure you didn't get caught coming into the city. Now, I need time to explain to you what's going on. What Nero is planning.
I didn't like the hesitation in her voice. Whatever Nero was planning, it had shaken Lu badly.
Besides, she continued, if you're going to stand any chance of beating him, you'll need someone on the inside. It's important that Nero think I tried to stop you, failed, then returned to him with my tail between my legs.
But my brain was too waterlogged to form any more questions. Never mind. You can explain when we get somewhere dry. Speaking of which, I've got an idea, Meg said. She jogged to the corner of the alley. Lu and I sloshed along beside her. The signs on the nearest corner informed us that we were at Lexington and 75th. Meg grinned.
See?
See what? I said.
What are you...
Her meaning hit me like an Amtrak quiet car. Oh, no, I said. No. They've done enough for us. I won't put them in any more danger, especially if Nero is after us.
But last time you were totally fine with...
Meg? No. Lu looked back and forth between us.
What are you talking about?
I wanted to stick my head in my backpack and scream. 6 months ago, I'd had no qualms about hitting up an old friend who lived a few blocks from here. But now, after all the trouble and heartbreak I'd brought to every place that had harbored me, no, I could not do that again. How about this? I drew the arrow of Dodona from my quiver.
We'll ask my prophetic friend. Surely it has a better idea. Perhaps access to last-minute hotel deals.
I lifted the projectile in my trembling fingers. Oh, great arrow of Dodona!
Is he talking to that arrow?
Lou asked Meg.
He talks to inanimate objects, Meg told her. Humor him. We need your advice,
I said, suppressing the urge to kick Meg in the shin. Where should we go for shelter? The arrow's voice buzzed in my brain.
Didst thou callest me thy friend?
It sounded pleased.
Yes.
I gave my companions a thumbs up. We need a place to hide out and regroup. Somewhere nearby. But away from Nero's surveillance cameras and whatnot.
The Emperor's whatnot is formidable indeed,
the arrow agreed.
But thou already knowest the answer to thy question, O Lester. Seekest thou the place of the seven-layer dip?
With that, the projectile fell silent. I groaned in misery. The arrow's message was perfectly clear.
Oh, for the yummy seven-layer dip of our hostess. Oh, for the comfort of that cozy apartment. But it wasn't right. I couldn't. What did it say?
Meg demanded. I tried to think of an alternative, but I was so tired I couldn't even lie. Fine, I said. We go to Percy Jackson's place.
4. This child is too cute. Please, no more adorable. Whoops, my heart just broke. Hello, Mrs. Jackson. Is Percy home?
I shivered and dripped on her welcome mat, my two equally bedraggled companions behind me. For a heartbeat, Sally Jackson remained frozen in her doorway, a smile on her face, as if she'd been expecting a delivery of flowers or cookies. We were not that. Her driftwood brown hair was tinseled with more gray than it was 6 months ago. She wore tattered jeans, a loose green blouse, and a blob of applesauce on the top of her bare left foot. She was not pregnant anymore, which probably explained the sound of the giggling baby inside her apartment. Her surprise passed quickly. Since she'd raised a demigod, she doubtless had lots of experience with the unexpected. Apollo, Meg, and... She sized up our gigantic, tattooed, mohawked train conductor. Hello. You poor things. Come in and dry off. The Jackson living room was as cozy as I remembered. The smell of baking mozzarella and tomatoes wafted from the kitchen. Jazz played on an old-fashioned turntable. Ah, Wynton Marsalis. Several comfy sofas and chairs were available to plop upon. I scanned the room for Percy Jackson, but found only a middle-aged man with salt-and-pepper hair, rumpled khakis, oven mitts, and a pink dress shirt, covered by a bright yellow apron splattered with tomato sauce. He was bouncing a giggly baby on his hip. The child's yellow onesie pajamas matched the man's apron so perfectly, I wondered if they'd come as a set. I'm sure the chef and baby made for an adorable, heartwarming scene. Unfortunately, I'd grown up on stories about titans and gods who cooked and or ate their children, so I was perhaps not quite as charmed as I might have been. There is a man in your apartment, I informed Mrs. Jackson. Sally laughed. This is my husband, Paul. Excuse me a sec. I'll be right back. She dashed toward the bathroom.
Hi, Paul smiled at us. This is Estelle.
Estelle giggled and drooled, as if her own name was the funniest joke in the universe. She had Percy's sea-green eyes and clearly her mother's good nature. She also had wisps of black and silver hair like Paul, which I had never seen on a baby. She would be the world's first salt-and-pepper toddler. All in all, it seemed Estelle had inherited a good genetic package.
Hello?
I wasn't sure whether to address Paul, Estelle, or whatever was cooking in the kitchen, which smelled delicious. Not to be rude, but we were hoping to... Oh, thanks, Mrs. Jackson. Sally had emerged from the bathroom and was now busily wrapping Meg, Lou, and me in fluffy turquoise bath towels. We were hoping to see Percy, I finished. Estelle squealed with delight. She seemed to like the name Percy. I'd like to see him too, Sally said. But he's on his way to the West Coast. With Annabeth. They left a few days ago. She pointed to a framed picture on the nearest end table. In the photo, my old friends Percy and Annabeth sat side by side in the Jackson family's dented Prius, both of them smiling out the driver's side window. In the back seat was our mutual satyr friend, Grover Underwood, mugging for the camera. Eyes crossed, tongue stuck out sideways, hands flashing peace signs. Annabeth leaned into Percy, her arms wrapped around his neck like she was about to kiss him, or possibly choke him. Behind the wheel, Percy gave the camera a big thumbs up. He seemed to be telling me directly, "We're out of here. You have fun with your quests or whatever."
He graduated high school,
Meg said, as if she'd witnessed a miracle. I know, Sally said. We even had cake. She pointed to another picture of Percy and Sally, beaming as they held up a baby blue